the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. LA has some ambitious sustainable energy goals, but to achieve them, the city has decided to go beyond just wind and solar. We'll tell you about the new option LA is insisting it needs. Plus, we pay tribute to an American automotive publication that showcased so much more than just cars.
It gives you a glimpse into growing up in inner city Los Angeles on the east side.
Mourning the end of Lowrider magazine, it's ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this chilly Tuesday. Coming up, research has shown that high school students struggle to tell the difference between fact-based information and that which is opinion or paid for. So, for example,
they're making decisions about voter fraud based on really problematic information.
But some folks at Stanford have come up with a curriculum aimed at helping students be better fact checkers. That story's coming up in about 20 minutes. We start, though, with real estate right here in Southern California. Over the last 10 years since the Great Recession, many vacant properties abandoned in foreclosure have been gobbled up by shell companies. Those are those nameless, faceless organizations that are more like holding companies than active businesses, and they've been paying all in cash. Now, for years, a law known as the Bank Secrecy Act has helped investigators and journalists unmask these buyers, but now the Treasury Department, which keeps those records, is denying information requests. So journalists are taking them to court. In a lawsuit filed yesterday, the Center for Investigative Reporting is demanding access to that information. For more, let's talk to the person behind that lawsuit, reporter Aaron Glantz. He's also the author of the book Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. Aaron, welcome back to Take Two.
Good to be with you.
All right, let's start with some context. Now, how pervasive are these kinds of purchases in the country, and what kind of effects are we seeing?
We're looking at 3 million homes and nearly 13 million apartment units around the country that are owned by LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies. We're looking at about 1 in 4 residential real estate purchases in America being made with cash. And in some of the more high-priced markets like LA, the Treasury Department is flagging more than 30% of these purchases as suspicious.
So if you're one of these prospective buyers, say you're looking to buy one of these houses or apartments, do you just basically get blasted out of the market?
Yeah, if you're wondering, like, where's the house that I can buy in my price range, part of it is that, you know, housing is just expensive now. But another part of it is that when you go shopping for a house, before you show up, someone else has already scooped it up with cash. And what we're trying to answer with this lawsuit is, who is that someone else? Because these homes are being bought up by shell companies, and they're registered to, like, P.O. boxes or lawyers' offices. They're registered to Delaware or maybe even internationally. And you can't find out at the county courthouse who bought the house next door. But there's one government agency that is keeping track of it. It's the Treasury Department. We filed a FOIA to get this information. They denied us. So now we're suing.
And when someone rents, say, at one of these places, they have no idea who they are renting from, who their landlord is, who to complain to if things aren't going well. I mean, is that the situation people find themselves in?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote in my book about the woman who had lived in her home for 30 years and was foreclosed on. And after the foreclosure, the house was bought by a company called Colfin AI California 5 LLC. And then she's told to pay rent to the shell company. So you try to deal with this landlord if your plumbing burst or your window breaks, you pick up the phone and call Colfin AI California 5 LLC. Who is that, right? So, of course, they assigned a property management company. But let's say that you cannot, you know, resolve your issue with the property management company. You want to go to the person who actually owns the property. You can't find out. If there's blight in your town, if the city of Los Angeles or some other Southern California city has a problem where there's a whole street of blighted properties all owned by shell companies and they want to take those shell companies to account, how do they do that if they can't even figure out who owns those properties?
Talking to Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Now, for years, investigative journalist just like you could find out who owns these properties. But as of this year, you've had trouble getting this information from the Treasury Department. You requested information but were denied twice. What reasons did they give you?
The Treasury Department is citing the Bank Secrecy Act, which was a law passed by Congress in 1970 to prevent money laundering. And what we're saying in our lawsuit is that we're not asking for the information the Treasury Department is using for law enforcement purposes. We're not trying to get in the way of their investigation of money laundering. We're trying to know this information that is very prosaic, a kind of information that used to be available at the county courthouse before people started to do ends around it by creating these shell companies.
All right, so now you're taking them to court and you're asking for those names of the people behind the corporations, their addresses. What are you going to do with the information?
We are going to begin investigating all the issues that are at stake in our cities. Who is buying up these properties? So if like you can't buy a house because all the houses have been taken off the market, there's a lot of theories out there, right? They're being bought by foreign investors who are stashing their money in vacant property. They're being bought by private equity firms and hedge fund guys like I wrote about in Homewreckers. They're just being bought up by techies or gentrifiers, right, who just happen to have more money. All of these theories are out there. We don't know which one of them is the most important because we don't have the information. And so what we want to do is to be able to get the information together so the public has a real accurate understanding of what's behind our housing crisis. You know, housing crisis isn't only about do we have enough housing? It's also about who owns the housing. And we cannot really make any kind of solution to this problem unless we understand the current state of affairs.
Aaron, what's more important here? Though? Is it just the names of the people who own these companies or the reasons for why it's been so secretive lately?
Well, I mean, we need to unmask that secrecy. We know how this happened, right? These LLCs were created decades ago to benefit oil companies and other international business ventures that wanted to limit the liability of their activities overseas. It's a limited liability company, right? LLC. It was never intended to be used as a tool for the purchases of houses to hide their identity. So what we're trying to do with the lawsuit is to pierce that corporate veil to understand who is actually buying these homes.
Ultimately, will information about the people behind these purchases change anything, considering California and the rest of the country struggling to solve its housing crunch?
I mean, we have a lot of issues, proposals that are being made, right? Like one thing that has been proposed is a vacancy tax because there's concern that homes are being left vacant because they're being bought by speculators to park money. Right? Wouldn't you like to know who the speculators are who are parking their money in these homes and how prevalent this is amidst all of the causes? Do we need more development? Do we need stricter rent control? Do we need less rent control? Which of these solutions is going to get us to a solution to the problems that we face? We can't know the answer to this unless we know who owns the house.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Oakland. He's now suing the Treasury Department to find out who's behind the corporations buying up housing around the country, including right here in LA. Aaron, thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. As California shifts away from fossil fuels, Los Angeles is looking for sustainable energy that is more reliable than wind and solar. The Department of Water and Power wants to revamp a coal power plant in Utah to fulfill that goal. And in a recent meeting, DWP announced they plan to convert that facility into a first-ever all-hydrogen plant. Energy reporter Sammy Roth has been covering this story for the LA Times. Sammy, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
All right. To start off, California has a mandate to produce 100% renewable energy by 2045. The clock is ticking, Sammy. What is LA doing to reach that goal?
So like a lot of the rest of the state, lots of wind and solar being added to the mix in Los Angeles. Electricity supply for the city is about a third renewable now, which you know, tracks pretty well with the rest of the state and is up a lot from where it was, you know, 10 years ago. But a lot of natural gas as well. That's another fossil fuel. That's another third of our energy here. And then there's this big coal plant in Utah, which has been the single largest power source for the city for a long time, which is why they're, you know, trying to get rid of it now.
Now, okay, so to that coal plant, DWP is closing it, transition to clean energy. What's going to happen with that facility?
So a couple of things. I mean, they basically have been planning for a while to tear it down and put a natural gas plant in its place, and also bring a lot of renewable energy over from the power lines that bring us that coal power right now. But, you know, this plan for a natural gas plant has been somewhat controversial because, you know, natural gas, like coal, is a fossil fuel. It contributes to climate change. So they've been, you know, they've been feeling some pressure on that lately, and that's what's, you know, produced this plan to, you know, build this gas plant, but ultimately replace the natural gas with hydrogen.
Now, hydrogen, clean, reliable energy source. How would that be processed at this Utah plant?
Yeah, so really good question. So hydrogen, you know, it's never been done before to build, you know, a plant at this scale that runs on hydrogen. So it's a challenge, and it's a little bit of a, you know, risk as to whether it's really going to work out or whether they'll be stuck with this gas plant. But the idea is basically to use renewable energy to power this process called electrolysis, where you split up water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen, because that's what water is made up of. And then you take the hydrogen and pretty much burn it in the power plant. So the idea is it's a renewable process to create the hydrogen, and then burning it is clean as well and doesn't generate carbon dioxide like it does when you burn gas.
So use renewable energy to make renewable energy? Is that the logic there?
It is. And, you know, it's funny because one of the, you know, the criticisms that I've heard leveled at this, you know, since I wrote this story is basically that this would be inefficient, that, you know, you'd be putting a lot more, you know, you'd be putting more electricity in to create this hydrogen than you'd be getting out of it at the end of the day. You know, that's certainly an argument against it. At the same time, you know, figuring out how to run a power grid without fossil fuels is going to be pretty tricky. And the engineers at LADWP think that for them, one of the ways to do this is to have, you know, basically a traditional power plant that you can fire up when the sun goes down, but to put hydrogen in it instead of natural gas.
And I guess, Sammy, we're talking to Sammy Roth, LA Times energy reporter. My first reaction to how you described it, I guess that's kind of part of the issue, right? Is that there's no perfect solution, it seems like, but I mean, it's a solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, 2045 seems a long way away, but the clock is ticking. I mean, utilities like LADWP make investments that are supposed to, you know, be paid off over decades and decades so that our power prices are not, you know, shooting up when they do stuff on the fly. So, yeah, they, you know, they're faced with this deadline. They have, like I said, a third of the city's electricity is natural gas right now. Another fifth of it is coal. They need to figure out what they're going to do about that if they're going to meet these goals and continue providing, you know, affordable, reliable electricity.
Is LA on pace, though? Say this hydrogen plant doesn't happen. With what they're doing right now, does the math work out where they would be aligned with 2045?
That's a good question. I would say generally yes, but this, you know, this thing with Intermountain Power Plant in Utah, this coal plant, and how they're going to replace it, I mean, that's a huge part of the city's energy portfolio, and they need to get that replacement right. It's, you know, it's a fifth of our city's power. They want to, like I said, bring lots of renewables in over that power line. But you know, one way or another, they need to figure out a replacement here that doesn't generate carbon. And, you know, maybe this is the way to do it. And if it doesn't work out, they're going to have to scramble to figure out something else.
Yeah, because it makes me wonder, Sammy, about the urgency. And I would think a lot of people would appreciate the urgency. There's a lot at stake here for just our area and the planet. But at the same time, if the urgency is maybe a little too urgent, is it something that maybe might be too much of a risky move for DWP?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that one of the reasons why they like the hydrogen proposal is if it doesn't work, they basically just keep burning natural gas at this plant instead. You know, there's been a lot of activism that's been, you know, focused around the idea of don't build this gas plant, you know, do all renewables in Utah. And I think, you know, they have a fear that could potentially leave them in a spot that they don't want to be in. So they'll build this gas plant. And if, you know, the hydrogen technology doesn't, you know, come to fruition like they want, they still have a gas plant. That's bad for the climate, but, you know, they still have a gas plant.
Now, the plan is to convert that facility in Utah to the hydrogen plant. What's the timeline? What has to happen next? And is there any chance that this plan will not quite happen when they want it to?
Yeah, so they basically, the question is right now that the technology is not fully there. So they're saying that when this thing opens in 2025, they're going to build it with these gas turbines that are basically capable of accepting a mix that's up to 30% hydrogen. So, you know, like filling these things with, you know, 30% hydrogen, 70% natural gas. That's where they say that the technology is at that they can do right now. You know, then over time, as companies like General Electric, Mitsubishi and Siemens build better turbines, they eventually revamp the technology and have turbines that can take 100% hydrogen. And the goal is to get to that by 2045, which is this target the state has set.
All right, that's LA Times energy reporter Sammy Roth. Sammy, as always, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, scale of 1 to 10, where would you rank your ability to recognize fake news? We'd all love to believe we're a 10, but this is the era of the alternative facts being a thing. Yeah, having a good nose for the truth can be a bit more challenging these days, and that's for grown-ups. Imagine how muddled that might be for our future leaders. That's right, teenagers. Well, a team at Stanford tested kids on their fact-checking skills, and the results were not good. Hear about the tool they came up with to help teens become better truth finders. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. All right, self-evaluate for a second. How do you feel about your internet fact-checking skills? You think you can distinguish between reliable and fake information on the internet? Well, in a nationwide study of almost 4,000 high school students, most of them could not. As a result, the group that conducted the study, the Stanford History Education Group, has created a new curriculum to help students think like a fact checker. This free online program is called Civic Online Reasoning, or COR. For more on COR, we have Joel Breakstone. He directs the Stanford History Education Group. Joel, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, before we get into the curriculum, can you please just tell us about how this whole project came about? Because it's my understanding that it's been 5 years in the making.
Yeah, that's right. About 5 years ago, we set out to create a set of assessments that assessed whether or not students could evaluate information on the internet. We asked students to do things like look at a website and determine whether or not it was a credible source of information. We asked them to distinguish between news stories and advertisements. And we asked students from all across the country, from middle school through college, to evaluate those sources. And across the board, they struggled to perform even the most basic evaluations of online information. We conducted that work in 2015 and 2016, and we released the results of that study in November of 2016, mm-hmm. when in the United States, the fear about fake news was at its peak, and especially in the wake of the 2016 presidential election. And we received an enormous amount of interest in the study and a lot of questions about what was the source of the problem and how we could help students do better.
Now, I don't know if it's more shocking or disappointing, Joel, to think that 4,000 students in your survey could not tell the difference between fact-based news and information that is, say, maybe opinion or paid content. But you know what? We live in the alternative facts era, right? I mean, there are people that say that's my truth, whether it's based in fact or not. Can you tell us a little bit about the culture we have now found ourselves in where we even need something like this?
I think part of it is the nature of the internet is that there is so much information readily available, and there are a great number of people who are seeking to spread misinformation or disinformation or propaganda. And so we are all faced with the challenge of trying to sort through that information when we go online, and there is so much information and there is so much problematic information that everybody has to do some work to figure out what is actually trustworthy and what's credible. What's alarming, though, is that we did a follow-up study on that original 2016 work just in the last year, and we found that things aren't any better. In fact, students continue to struggle, and they can't do some things that we really hope they could do. For instance, we showed students a Facebook video that purported to show voter fraud during the 2016 Democratic primary elections, and more than half the students thought that it presented strong evidence of voter fraud during the primary elections. It turns out that those videos were from Russia and had nothing to do with voter fraud in the United States. But students didn't ask this basic question of who's behind this information and where were these videos taken? And as a result, they're making decisions about voter fraud based on really problematic information.
Now, we're going to get to civic online reasoning in just a second. I just want to ask you, Joel, how much of this you think is just teenagers being teenagers? Sometimes, you know, we get scatterbrained. I remember as a teenager, I didn't focus all the time.
I think that across the board, we see in other venues, adults struggling mightily to make these same kind of evaluations of online sources. Part of our research was actually to work with professional historians and professional fact checkers and freshmen at Stanford University. And we asked them to evaluate a series of different sources from the web and to distinguish whether or not a source was credible or not. And we found that those historians and the Stanford students actually struggled as well. And that they were unable to identify trustworthy sources.
Talking to Joel Breakstone, directs the Stanford History Education Group. All right, so let's talk about Civic Online Reasoning Program, or COR. Who is it for and how is it assessed?
So we created these materials for teachers to use with their middle school and high school students. And it's based on that research that we did with professional fact checkers. We watched them as they went on the web to evaluate a series of different sources. And we saw that they had strategies that were much more effective than the historians or the Stanford students. For instance, one of the first thing that we saw the fact checkers do was they almost instantly left an unfamiliar website. They wanted to see what other sources on the web said about it rather than trusting what the source said about itself. And as a result, they ended up finding out a lot more information than the historians or the students who spent a great deal of time reading closely on that original website.
No, it's okay. So the teaching the skill, though, the skill to have that fact check and bring, how do you teach that?
We think it's really important to provide students with structured opportunities to look at real sources from the web and practice those skills of the fact checker. So of directing students to both trustworthy and less trustworthy sources and decide whether or not they trust them and to explain their thinking and then to get feedback from their teachers. So rather than having to just guess at what's trustworthy, they have opportunities to try out these new skills in the comfort of their own classroom rather than in the more high-risk environment of making decisions that are going to affect themselves and their communities and ultimately the country when we think about the decisions that people are going to make leading up to elections.
Joel, are there any basic questions that you have people have in their head as they're trying to suss out what's real and what isn't?
Without a doubt. When we watch the professional fact checkers evaluate sites, they ask three basic questions. One, who's behind the information? Two, what's the evidence? And then three, what do other sources say? And those three questions guided all of their evaluations. Rather than spending time thinking about whether or not it was a .org website or a .com or a .edu, they used those three questions to quickly evaluate sites and come up with much stronger conclusions about what's credible and what's not.
Depending on the person, though, Joel, wondering if question two and three might be squishy sometimes. I mean, what's the evidence? People see evidence differently. And what other sources say, well, other sources might have differing opinions there as well. I mean, I know facts are facts, but, you know, the way people see things, doesn't that play in somehow?
Without a doubt, individuals are going to bring their own lenses to every single topic that they're searching for on the internet. However, if we think about those questions, it can guide the way we decide whether or not to trust a source. Rather than just accepting claims at face value, pausing to say, is there evidence here, can allow us to come to a much better conclusion rather than just saying, oh, here's a picture of some mutated daisies that claims that it is evidence of the nuclear disaster in Fukushima. That was one of the tasks that we gave to high school students. Overwhelmingly, they thought that that was strong evidence of the results of the disaster at Fukushima. There is no evidence that that picture comes from near to the disaster site or that the daisies look that way because of the nuclear disaster. If we could just get students to pause and say, what's the evidence for this? Where's this coming from? We could avoid some of the most common errors that students make online.
Joel, these folks taking this and that you tried this on, I mean, these are our next leaders. These are the people that are going to guide this country going forward. What is at stake here if these critical skills don't improve?
I think the health of our democracy is at risk, that democracies depend on access to trustworthy, credible information. And so if we can't prepare young people to seek out and evaluate sources on the web, the health of our democracy is at risk.
Joel Breakstone directs the Stanford History Education Group behind the Civic Online Reasoning Curriculum. That's a program that helps students stay more vigilant online. Joel, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
All All right, staying with education, California's Native American communities have long had very low college graduation rates. Lack of support and mentoring for Native American students is often cited as a reason, so now more universities are appointing tribal liaisons. The most recently hired person to this post at Cal State San Bernardino will be on the job for a year starting next month. KPECC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez paid a visit to ask how he's making a difference.
There are 20,000 students enrolled at Cal State San Bernardino, but only 45 are Native Americans. Enter Vincent Whipple, the university's tribal liaison.
I'm Native American. I'm Lakota through my father, Diné and Navajo through my mother.
Tribal identification is important, he says, because it shows Native Americans that one of them is in a leadership position in a mainstream institution.
Being Native really gives Native people a point of contact here on the campus. A few of our partners have told us in the past that because they didn't know who to contact here, they didn't feel comfortable, encouraging their students to come to this campus.
Who are those partners? They're the local Indian reservations with thousands of members, San Manuel, Saboba, Agua Caliente, and others. Growing families and tribal enterprises are motivating tribal leaders to push schools and colleges to do a better job educating the region's estimated 80,000 American Indians. Cindra Weber is part of that effort. She oversees a Native American support program at San Bernardino Public Schools. She keeps a list of colleges that are good for Native students. Where's Cal State San Bernardino on that list?
Well, until they hired Vince Whipple, at the very bottom. Because I've had Indian children go there, they have no support system.
What have those children told you once they've been to Cal State San Bernardino?
There's no one here!
Vincent Whipple wants to build what tribal liaisons have done at other campuses, like Cal State San Marcos, where students can now graduate with a degree in American Indian Studies. Tishmal Turner became tribal liaison there 13 years ago.
We went from having a minor to having a major, being able to offer programming on our campus to support and attract American Indian students.
Three of Cal State's 23 campuses have tribal liaisons. San Diego State University is recruiting one and will be the fourth. System-wide, the six-year graduation rate for Native Americans is 50%. Jacob Coyne, the vice president of public affairs at the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, says that may be a legacy of destructive U.S. government policies, such as the federal boarding school program that separated Native American youth from their families and their culture.
I think that experience left many generations of Native people just a little bit shy and a little bit suspicious about education generally.
Coyne says his tribe has donated millions of dollars over the years to area universities. At Cal State San Bernardino, tribal donations have gone to build the student union, the campus observatory, and funded the tribal liaison office. Coyne says the tribe is now pushing campuses to match funds.
It shouldn't just be tribes funding Native initiatives at universities. It should go way beyond that.
That way, he says, the entire institution has a stake in lifting up Native American students and incorporating Native knowledge into its mission. One of the goals is to create environments with more of the communal values and tight-knit family relationships that many Native youth grow up with.
So I was born and raised on the Los Coyotes Reservation, which is in San Diego County.
UCLA student Daniel Streamer says it's been difficult to find those values at his campus. It led to a very difficult time when he learned a relative on the reservation had died days before his first year at UCLA.
I felt pretty alienated, I guess, because my family was at home dealing with our loss, and my siblings and I were up here at school.
UCLA has a strong Native Studies department and added a tribal liaison last year. Cal State San Bernardino liaison Vincent Whipple says it's a model for what he wants to accomplish, which is to double Native American student enrollment in the next 2 years. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, now to the military. Not everyone who served in uniform is considered a veteran, including some people who spent years in the National Guard. Guardsmen who respond to domestic missions, such as providing disaster assistance or working along the southern U.S. border, may not qualify for VA benefits. It's an issue that Congress is now studying, as Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
In April 2018, President Trump ordered 2,000 National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border to aid Homeland Security. During a tour in October 2018, Border Patrol spokesman William Rogers complimented the California National Guard, who were working inside a Border Patrol station in San Diego, acting as dispatchers and monitoring cameras.
What's most important about it to us is the fact that prior to the National Guard soldiers filling these spots, we had to have sworn agents filling these spots.
Despite the kind words, some of these Guard troops working along the border in uniform may never meet the federal definition of a veteran. One of the things Guard troops need to qualify for VA benefits, like health care or the GI Bill, is to serve 180 days continuously on active duty. That means being requested by the federal government under specific circumstances, says Daniel Elkins, a special forces operator with a Guard unit in L.A. I reached him via Skype in Utah, where he's training to deploy overseas.
This affects many members of the National Guard. For example, currently, there's a federally declared border crisis that's going on.
Even though the president asked for the Guard and the federal government paid for the operation, their orders don't count toward being considered a veteran under federal law. Elkins also works with the Enlisted Association of National Guard United States, which is lobbying to bring greater parity between active duty and the Guard and Reserve troops, like making it easier for them to qualify to become veterans by letting them add up all the times they spend on federal orders instead of just serving 180 consecutive days.
Those should be added up, and when you meet that threshold, you should be considered a veteran and rate the same level of benefits and service as an active duty counterpart.
Most of the time, Guard troops are under the control of the governor, who can call them up to help with natural disasters like the wildfires in California. But there are a variety of missions. Congressman Mike Levin, whose district covers parts of San Diego County, chairs a veteran subcommittee which recently held hearings on these parity issues.
We haven't followed a very basic principle, which is if you are expected to be doing the same sort of thing, putting your life on the line for whatever particular mission, I believe you ought to be able to get the same pay and benefits.
Levin says Congress has been slow to respond to the changing role of the Guard, which has been used more consistently since September 11, 2001.
The expectations and the demands placed on our National Guard and Reserves that perhaps weren't there previously, we have to make sure that federal policy reflects that.
Elkins, the Guard Special Forces operator preparing for deployment, says he's talked with former Guard troops who applied for benefits under the GI Bill after reporting to disasters like Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast or Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico.
And these members, they serve, they deploy, they're being told that they're being deployed, and they assume that they have the same level of benefits.
But they don't. He says that impacts retention in the Guard, but the consequences can run much deeper. Those federal benefits include long-term mental health care at the VA. The VA estimates 919 suicides in 2017 among Guard and Reserve members who never achieved veteran status, all former military, but not considered veterans. In San Diego, I'm Steve Walsh.
You know, a car magazine can be just that simple. Pages and pages of really cool pictures of cars, nothing more. However, one publication that a lot of Angelenos grew up reading was so much more than that.
It gives you a glimpse into growing up in inner city Los Angeles on the east side.
But now it will no longer print. Coming up, a tribute to Low Rider magazine when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, just because it feels like the holidays, that doesn't mean the news stops and says, go, relax, have a good end of the year. There's lots of it to get to.
It's never like that.
Nick Roman, host of ATC, All Things Considered, is coming up this afternoon with what he's got to tell you about.
Well, what's coming up on All Things Considered at 4, you might have heard the president has sent House Speaker Nancy Pelosi an angry six-page letter complaining about tomorrow's impeachment vote by the full House. It blasts her for allowing impeachment to move forward. It warns her about the political consequences. NPR's Mara Liasson will take a look at that. We'll also have a closer look at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision not to take up a case about homeless people sleeping in public places. Of course, LA and other local governments say they can't enforce some basic health and safety laws because of it. And with Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You back on top of the Billboard charts after 25 years, you might wonder why there aren't any lasting Christmas songs to take its place. I have no idea, but we're going to try and find an answer.
Wait a second. Wham! Last Christmas. That is my go-to Christmas song. That thing is going to last forever, Nick.
Yeah, I'm still stuck with the Chipmunks.
Oh, my God. you would be, too. That's Nick Roman. News all day long here on KPCC on All Things Considered. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez, and that song speaks to a whole generation of Latinos in Southern California. Lowrider culture and its community are emblematic to East L.A., but that community took a hit last week when Santa Ana-based magazine Lowrider announced that they had just printed their last issue ever. Now, it's not clear when or if the magazine will continue online, leaving many of its devoted readers in the dark. Robert Velez was a loyal reader for decades and is part of one of the world's oldest car clubs, Duke's Car Club. And he joins us now to talk about the magazine, how it influenced him over the years, and how much it helped launch lowrider culture to an international stage. Robert, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, okay, for someone who maybe has never, ever seen an issue of Lowrider magazine, they might think, well, it's just pages and pages of cars. But what was Lowrider magazine really about?
Lowrider magazine was about the Latino Chicano culture and how the car culture affected them as far as how they fix up their cars. In its early years, I believe it was 1977 when the first issue was put out. Lowriding in the 1970s was at its peak. Lowriding has been around since the 50s and 60s, but in the 70s is when all the different car clubs from the east sides of Los Angeles, you know, car clubs like the Duke's Car Club, which I grew up around, the Imperials, they were really starting to take lowriding to another level as far as organization, as far as the quality of the lowrider car builds. So there was a need for a magazine, and Lowrider was that magazine. Something for me personally opened my eyes to my background, my Chicano culture. I would buy every issue and read and learn about, like, this magazine is the first time I read about the Chicano moratorium, the civil rights movement, Cesar Chavez. It was in Lowrider magazine.
It was a total peek into a culture that really the rest of America didn't know anything about.
Right, exactly. They didn't just cover lowrider cars. It gives you a glimpse into growing up in inner city Los Angeles on the east sides. Typically, all of us didn't have a lot of resources or money, but what we did have is a passion, and it reflected in the quality
your
of the
craftsmanship, bills,
the craftsmanship.
Your art. So like, you brought some magazines, right?
Yes, I actually brought my lowrider magazines that I had as a kid from the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And I'm in several of them as far as just shots. We used to cruise Whittier Boulevard. And unfortunately, at that time, there was a bad stigma with them. And there was also the car club wars where different car clubs were like trying to one up. And yeah, it just got kind of not good.
Saw a lowrider, they thought there's criminals in
exactly.
the car.
Right? And me personally, growing up as a kid, when I saw a lowrider pulled over in the LA County Sheriff's or the Huntington Park Police, they would have the guys sitting on the curb. That was like, wow, that's negative. I'd have to be like us when we grow up, right? So when we started driving, we didn't want to go necessarily towards a lowrider, traditional lowrider, because of the bad stigma. So we kind of veered to the next thing was an economical Volkswagen. So that's how me and my friends, we started doing Volkswagens with all the chrome and flash and nice, beautiful paint jobs, lowered to the extreme. And we were building up for cruising, like the 70s.
And that's what you're in, right? You're in one of those in the magazine.
Yes, I'm in a Volkswagen on Whittier Boulevard cruising.
What did it mean to you when the first time, you said you've been in the magazine several times, but the first time you were in Lowrider magazine with your car, I mean, what was that moment like for you?
At that moment, it was really meaningful to me because, one, the notoriety of being in the magazine, but that sums up me as a teenager growing up in the east side and growing up in Huntington Park, hanging out at Elysian Park. This is way before social media, before pages and all that. We just hung out. That's where all the teens hung out. We all congregated, and we all ended up at Tommy's, the original Tommy's, after our cruising.
Talking to Robert Velez, he is part of one of the world's oldest car clubs, Duke's Car Club. One of the things, Robert, I remember when I was a kid, and maybe I didn't realize it then, but I realize it now, is that when you'd see Lowrider magazine on the rack, it would be there along with other quote-unquote American magazines like Sports Illustrated or Newsweek.
Yes.
So it was a slice of faces that looked like me, that looked like my uncles, that looked like my aunts, right next to other American magazines. It felt like, hey, we could all belong.
For sure. Again, I grew up in Huntington Park, but my mom and dad sent me to a private high school away from Huntington Park in Bellflower called St. John Bosco High School. So at that time, there wasn't that many Chicanos or other groups there at that high school. So for me, I got to sell both sides, which was awesome because over there, they were into hot rods and into muscle cars and a different type of car. And I would bring my Cal-style vintage Volkswagens, which were all lowered and way different. And I was able to share with them and show them the Chicano culture and kind of break stereotypes. You know, all gangbangers were in the trouble, you know. I was proud to say that Lowrider Magazine and Lowriding could coexist with the other genres of automotive customizing. Even today, Lowrider, like I travel the world now with my vintage Volkswagens. I'm the president of the Vintage Volkswagen Club of America, Los Angeles region. Today, lowriding is still strong in Japan. It's almost kind of like mainstream.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, where do you see that this particular car culture going now? I mean, is it a relic of the past or is there some young blood in it?
I don't think it's a relic of the past because you can see it today in media. You can see it in people wanting to emulate that raw, like, coming from the neighborhood kind of thing. So you see it in the art, in the tattoos now with Mr. Cartoon. He brought it to the masses, that fine line prison art tattoo style. I go to shows now. I'll give you an example. I went to a show in the UK. There was an older gentleman, probably in his 60s or 70s, and he had a lowrider and he had a Cal-style Volkswagen that you could just plop up and drop into 1980 Los Angeles, East LA. And he loved it and he was happy with it.
That's the reach of Lowrider Magazine.
Exactly.
Right? One last thing, though. It is going to be no more in print, nothing you can hold in your hand with paper. I mean, it's sad, but considering social media, considering phones, video, I mean, it's going to live on, but are you sad that you can't hold it in your hand and flip the pages anymore?
Lowrider Magazine, the last few years, they've done a lot with digital media, especially with the Lowrider Role Models episodes, where they would profile various lowriders that are professionals, you know, doctors, lawyers, giving back to the community, trying to show the rest of the world that lowriding is not a bad thing or the way people thought it was back in the 70s and 60s. And I think with the digital media, it's going to go forward more and even stronger because it's a worldwide reach and it's very easy and it's instant. But I am sad that the actual magazine is going to go away. I mean, even now, like I was just looking at some of the first issue, that 77 issue, you know, people are selling it for $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 because it's a paper issue is going away, you know. I think people love the Southern California lowrider car culture. By building them, by dressing, by everything. And still, I believe it's still going to go strong.
And we have Lowrider Magazine to thank for all that. That's California car culture expert Robert Velez talking about the history and future of lowrider culture. Robert, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
A local author born, raised, and still living in Riverside, whose family ties range from African and Mexican-American to Cherokee, Creek, Swiss, Filipino, Haitian, and a lot more in between. She came out with a memoir detailing that history, focusing on the women who have had to survive violence spanning continents. Susan Straits in the Country of Women is coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Susan Strait is the author of 8 novels, including the National Book Award finalist High Wire Moon, about an undocumented migrant mother attempting to reconnect with the daughter from whom she was separated. Her writing is prized for its transcendent beauty and a deeply rooted sense of place, which for Strait is Southern California. She was born and raised and still lives right in Riverside, but her family is mixed race, with ancestors going back generations in the United States. And that history is the subject of her first memoir, In the Country of Women. It came out earlier this year, but as we rerun some of our favorite conversations we had with authors this year, we bring you her story again.
Hi, I'm Susan Strait. My new book is In the Country of Women. It is so hard to find women, and that's the biggest thing that I think about so often after I finish this book. Really, I was writing it for my whole life. My mother-in-law invited me into her house when I was 16, not yet 16 years old, and said, come make you a plate, and brought me into the kitchen And then she started telling me a story. When you're looking at even going through Ancestry, for example, you're trying to find a woman. The original ancestor, Fine, that I wrote about, she was known as Fine, Viney, Fanny, Finey, and Vinny. She had five names. She was married three times. So at each census, for example, someone didn't really even listen to her say her name or ask her how to spell it. And that's something no one ever talks about. Women's names get lost. They get married. You're not sure what the husband's name was. How do you find them? So it was a combination mostly of all the family legends, all of those great oral storytelling practices that families like ours use, and then spending 5 years trying to track down someone specific. Our family, you can't even really break it down. I mean, Fine was the daughter of Catherine, who'd been an enslaved woman who probably was second generation from the African continent. Her father was Henry Ely, said to be a free Cherokee, but sometimes also identified as a free mixed-race man. On my side, my mom was born in Switzerland, and my natural father was French descended. It's really fascinating then that I went to junior high and high school, and everyone was military around us. We were between three Air Force bases, March, Norton, and Camp Pendleton. So I grew up with guys whose moms were from Yokohama, Japan, and whose dads were black men from Texas. My neighbor, Richard Box, his mom was from Germany, and his father was a black African-American man from Texas. We all married each other. When I brought home Dwayne, who's 6'4", a basketball player, she said, "Thank God we'll have some height in the family, because my mom is 4'11", and she's from Switzerland." And that's what she said. For our neighborhood and for a place like Southern California where we grew up, it was about love and music, and you were kind of free to go out and be in the club and dance and have a good time, and people married who they married. Growing up in a way that I did, where my high school was a third black, a third white, a third Mexican-American, and in between, we had friends who were indigenous. We had a large population of Japanese American people whose parents had been interned. Everyone was a product, in a way, of mixing because of the military and because of war and because of migration. How could you have had a better way to grow up? And my three daughters grew up in the same place, and yet it was different. I think the thing that ends up in this book and that ends up having shaped me as a human more than anything else was that all of our parents had come from somewhere else and told us stories about why their female ancestors, almost always female, migrated west. The strangest thing is they all migrated, and then here we met each other in junior high. We are surrounded by people who never leave Riverside, not even to go to the beach. I live a mile from where the hospital where I was born, where my ex-husband was born, all of our siblings, everyone that we know. I think we felt like this was the promised land for us. We were told it was the promised land by those ancestors who survived these terrible hardships. For undergraduate, I went to USC, and I was afraid to take a class with T.C. Boyle, and so I never did, because he knows I say this about him. He looked like a Hell's Angel from Fontana, and my aunt had been married to a Hell's Angel from Fontana, and so I thought, I'm scared of this person. But he was so kind to me. When I was a senior, I wrote my first two short stories, and he invited me to his office, and he said, "You have to go to graduate school, and these are the five places you should apply." And one of them was Iowa, and one of them was UMass Amherst. And I got into Iowa, but I was already engaged to my future husband, and he said, "There aren't any black people in Iowa, we can't go there." And when we saw UMass Amherst, he said, "That'll work, because we can go see the Lakers play the Celtics at the Boston Garden." And so that's why I went to UMass Amherst. And when I got there, James Baldwin was teaching. He was a visiting writer in residence, and I was chosen to be in his workshop. And it was transformative. James Baldwin was not only kind to my fiction, and also encouraged me to write this memoir even back then. His driver, Rico, and his secretary, Skip, were tall, young black men, and they played basketball with Dwayne. Like, so they would come pick us up, or we would meet out at James Baldwin's, and the guys would play basketball in the driveway, and James Baldwin and I would talk about fiction. I felt like the luckiest person in the world, because at 12, I had read the two books that changed my life. One was Toni Morrison's novel Sula, which I mention over and over again in this memoir, because there were things that happened to me when I was a young woman that I measured my life by that novel, Sula. I read it every year, and I'm 58 now. And the other book that really changed me was Go Tell It on the Mountain, and the idea that this family and the secrets that they kept and the sort of revelation that John receives at the end could be told in beautiful prose. How could I have been so lucky as to meet James Baldwin? I still marvel at it. What he taught me, and one of the things I like to say in the book, is that secondary characters are the most important characters in our lives, and that colored everything I wrote in my fiction. He said, it's always the secondary characters that carry your story forward. Don't forget that. And as I was working on novels and then this memoir, of course, the book was not about me at all. The book is about all of the other people. That really was a life-changing experience.
That's author Susan Strait telling us about her memoir that came out earlier this year, In the Country of Women. All right, just a heads up, KPCC will air the House impeachment debate and vote tomorrow. It starts at 6 a.m., and the plan is to carry the debate until it goes all the way through the vote. And we hope here at Take Two to be able to offer you analysis. That is the plan, but again, we're airing it all day until it ends. All right, you can also find us on social media. We're all over it, at Take Two on Twitter. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Plus, if you miss the show, just go wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two hopes to be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.